You know, every time you merge onto the Taconic State Parkway, you are basically entering this arena where the laws of physics and the laws of liability are just about to violently collide.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all operate under the shared illusion of control when we drive, right?
Right, you trust the brake lights in front of you. You trust the lane markers.
Yeah, but the ecosystem of a high-speed commuter corridor is just incredibly fragile. And, well, when one variable fails, the resulting shockwave goes so far beyond just crumpled metal. It triggers this massive, totally adversarial legal machine.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are examining a really sobering, highly detailed report we've been reviewing that centers on a tragic multi-vehicle crash in Cortland, New York.
It's a tough read for sure.
It really is. So our mission today for you listening is to unpack this specific tragedy, but more importantly, to decode the sort of hidden mechanisms of multi-car collisions in the New York City metro area.
Right, because there's a whole tactical playbook that insurance companies use in the aftermath.
Exactly. And we're analyzing a case study presented in the text of how a veteran attorney, Norman Gershon, operates as the antidote to all this post-crash chaos. Okay, so let's unpack this, starting with the stark reality of what actually happened on the ground in Cortland.
Yeah, so the incident detailed in our source material really strips away that illusion of control we were just talking about. It involves a fatal multi-vehicle collision near Locust Avenue in Cortland.
Just awful.
Yeah, a 28-year-old man lost his life, and two others suffered severe injuries.
A completely devastating loss of life. And when you read the breakdown of the environment where this happened, I mean, it paints a picture of a system that's just operating on a knife's edge.
It really does.
And our source points out that this isn't just an isolated anomaly. This is a baseline reality across Westchester County and the broader NYC metropolitan area.
Well, the text specifically flags the infrastructure itself as a compounding factor. I mean, we are looking at Route 9, Route 6, the Taconic State Parkway, the Sawmill River Parkway, the Hutchinson River Parkway, Interstate 287, and the Cross County Parkway.
Honestly, if you commute in this area, your blood pressure probably just spiked hearing those names.
Oh, for sure.
But, like, why those specific roads? Why are they such a recipe for disaster compared to, modern interstate?
It really comes down to historical design just colliding with modern reality. I mean, many of these parkways were conceptualized in the 1920s and 30s.
Wow, that long ago.
Yeah, they were quite literally designed for leisurely Sunday drives in early automobiles. So you have narrow lanes, virtually non-existent shoulders, blind curves, and these incredibly short merge
Oh
ramps.
man, those merge ramps are the worst.
Right, now take that 1930s infrastructure and inject thousands of tons of modern heavy metal traveling at 70 miles per hour every single day.
It's a disaster waiting to happen because you are mixing hyper-local traffic-like people just running to the grocery store between communities like White Plains, Yonkers, New Rochelle, Mount Vernon, Bronxville, Harrison, or Rye with exhausted long-haul commuters.
What's happened?
And the catalysts for the inevitable collapse of this system are almost entirely human error. I mean, the report lists distracted driving, speeding, unsafe lane changes, failure to yield, impaired driving, and aggressive driving.
And when a driver who's, say, looking at their phone fails to yield on a narrow, shoulderless parkway, you rarely get a simple two-car fender bender.
Right, there's no room for error.
None. The kinetic energy has no place to dissipate safely. A heavy SUV traveling at highway speeds carries this massive amount of forward momentum. When it strikes a slowing vehicle, that kinetic energy transfers violently through the first car, pushing it into the next and then the next.
Basically a chain reaction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The occupants absorb that transferred energy, which leads to catastrophic, life-altering injuries.
So, the physical devastation is horrifying, but the moment the dust settles and the physical kinetic energy stops bouncing between the cars, a completely different type of collision happens. The legal one.
Oh, yeah, the legal aftermath is a whole other beast.
But wait, why is a multi-vehicle crash so much harder to resolve than your standard accident? Because on the surface, shouldn't it be obvious?
You would think so, right?
Yeah, like if car A hits car B and car B gets shoved into car C, shouldn't the police just look at the damage, hand car A a ticket, and close the file?
What's fascinating here is that the physical mechanics might seem completely straightforward to an outside observer, but the legal reality involves an immediate, highly sophisticated blame game.
The blame game, right?
You aren't just dealing with two drivers swapping insurance cards on the side of the road. You are dealing with multiple insurance conglomerates, and each one steps in instantly to construct a narrative that deflects liability away from their policyholder.
Because the financial exposure is enormous. I mean, if you are the insurance company for car A, you're looking at paying medical bills and property damage for potentially four other vehicles.
Which means they look for any fracture in the narrative. So car B's driver might claim they were at a complete stop when car A hit them from behind, pushing them into car C.
Makes sense.
But car A's insurance company will argue that car B actually rear-ended car C first, creating a sudden hazard that car A couldn't avoid.
Oh, wow. So you have three drivers, three different perspectives, heavily influenced by trauma and adrenaline, and three massive corporations financially incentivized to point the finger at someone else.
Exactly.
How do you actually find the truth in that kind of mess?
Well, you have to follow a massive, highly technical evidence trail. The source outlines exactly what investigators and attorneys have to assemble, and it goes so far beyond just a basic police report. In a severe chain reaction crash, they bring in accident reconstruction experts.
I always hear that term, accident reconstruction. What are they actually doing? Are they just looking at the crumpled hoods and, like, guessing?
Not at all. They are essentially reverse engineering a physics equation. They look at the resting positions of the vehicles, but more importantly, they analyze something called crush deformation.
Crush deformation.
Yeah. They measure exactly how far the metal of each car was pushed inward. By understanding the specific stiffness coefficients of those exact vehicle models, they can calculate the exact delta V.
Which is the sudden change in velocity.
Right. The exact change in velocity that each vehicle experienced upon impact.
That is wild. So they can mathematically prove whether a car was hit while moving or hit while stopped just based on how the metal folded.
Yes, exactly. And they combine that with coefficient of friction calculations based on skid marks, data downloaded from the vehicle's onboard event data recorders, traffic camera footage, and cell phone records.
Cell phone records, too.
Oh, yeah. If they suspect distracted driving, they will actually subpoena the cellular provider to see if data packets were being transmitted at the exact millisecond of the calculated impact.
That is just a staggering amount of data to collect.
Yeah.
But the text issues a major warning here, right? Yeah. This is a ticking clock.
Time is absolutely the enemy of the victim in these cases. Skid marks wash away in the next rainstorm. Municipal traffic cameras often overwrite their hard drives every 72 hours.
Wow, just 3 days.
Yeah. And eyewitness memories fade, or they become contaminated by news reports. If the investigation doesn't start within days or sometimes even hours, the mathematical foundation of the entire case just evaporates.
Which really exposes the major tension in our deep dive today. While the victim is in the trauma ward undergoing surgery or heavily medicated, the insurance companies are already moving.
Always.
The source notes, they begin protecting their own interests almost immediately. It's like an opposing sports team running plays while the injured party is still trying to figure out what game they're playing.
That's a great way to put it. You really have to view the insurance industry in these scenarios not as a safety net, but as a casino.
A casino.
Yeah. The adjusters are the house. They play the odds every single day. They have endless resources, vast teams of investigators, and a mathematical model built entirely on the assumption that an overwhelmed, injured person will eventually fold.
Just accept a low payout to make the process end.
Exactly.
So they're counting cards while the victim doesn't even know they're sitting at a table. But the source provides a very specific action plan for handling the immediate aftermath. And the very first directive is to seek immediate medical attention, even if you feel fine.
This is so important. The adrenaline dump after a highway collision is a profound biological painkiller. You might have micro tears in your spinal ligaments or a traumatic brain injury and literally not realize it for 48 hours.
Right, your body's just trying to survive.
Exactly. So from a medical standpoint, you need a physician's evaluation. And from a legal standpoint, you are establishing an absolute timeline. You are creating a documented medical baseline that undeniably links your physical trauma to the exact hour of the crash.
Which prevents the casino from arguing later that you, I don't know, actually hurt your back at the gym 3 weeks later.
Precisely.
The text also advises reporting the crash to law enforcement to get an official record, photographing the scene, and getting witness contact information directly if you're physically able.
Yeah, if you can move, get those photos.
But there is one crucial warning that stood out above everything else here. Avoid giving recorded statements to the other driver's insurance company before understanding your rights.
The adjusters who make those early phone calls are highly, highly trained. They will express deep empathy. They will sound incredibly helpful.
They act like your friend.
Right. They'll suggest that a quick recorded statement is just a formality to process your claim and get your car fixed faster.
And what they're actually doing is fishing for a reason to deny the claim.
Always. They are looking for the victim to casually say something like, "Oh, I didn't see them coming," and then they will later weaponize that to argue you were inattentive.
Unbelievable.
Or they will ask, "How are you feeling today?" And if you just politely reply, "I'm doing okay," that snippet of audio will be played in front of a jury 3 years later to argue your injuries weren't actually that severe.
That is just so manipulative. So how does an average person navigate a system designed to outmaneuver them at every turn? To beat the casino, you need someone who knows how to count cards in that specific environment.
You really do.
And the source article points to a specific case study for this. And honestly, as podcasters for the firm, we're proud to highlight them. The law offices of Norman Gershon.
Yeah, the text frames Norman Gershon's 35-year track record as basically a blueprint for the kind of specialized representation required in this hostile environment.
Over three decades.
Yep. He handles cases across Westchester County, White Plains, Yonkers, the Bronx, Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn. But, you know, the most revealing detail in the article is his reputation within the legal industry itself.
Oh, but this part was fascinating.
Right. He is explicitly described as the attorney other lawyers call to try their toughest cases.
That dynamic is so interesting to me. Why would a lawyer hand over their own client to someone else?
Because of the actuarial data the insurance companies use.
What do you mean?
Well, the major insurers use these really sophisticated software programs to evaluate claims, and those programs actually track the specific trial records of plaintiff attorneys.
Wait, really? They have a database on the lawyers.
Oh, absolutely. If your lawyer has a reputation for always settling out of court because they are afraid of a jury trial, the insurance company's algorithm will automatically lowball your settlement offer. They literally know your lawyer won't fight.
Wow. But if they see a litigator who actually takes cases to a jury and wins, that changes things.
Exactly. The threat of the trial forces the insurance company to offer a fair payout. Insurance companies know and fear Norman Gershon for exactly this reason.
So other lawyers bring in a heavy hitter like Gershon because having a known trial threat on the docket completely changes the math for the insurance company.
It changes everything.
And the firm's model is you only pay if you win, which takes the financial risk off the victim.
Right, which is huge when you're already drowning in medical bills.
And if anyone listening is dealing with this right now, the firm's direct line from the text is 914-485-4444. But I want to look closely at these verdicts listed in the source, because they don't just show his record, they illustrate the sheer scale of the damage in these types of crashes.
The numbers are staggering.
We're talking about tens of millions of dollars recovered. For instance, a $16.5 million verdict for an auto passenger hit by a bus, and another $14.5 million settlement in a serious bus accident.
Bus and commercial trucking accidents just add an entirely new layer of complexity to everything we've discussed today.
Yeah.
You aren't just dealing with state traffic laws at that point.
What else is there?
You are navigating the federal motor carrier safety regulations. You have to investigate driver logbooks, corporate maintenance records, and these really complex corporate shell games.
Shell games, yeah.
Yeah, where the bus might be owned by one LLC, it's maintained by another, and the driver is employed by a third. Proving liability in that web requires massive, massive resources.
That makes a lot of sense. Then there's a $5.445 million verdict for a motor vehicle accident. And this one really caught my eye. A $5.068 million verdict involving a sideswipe collision.
That's a big one.
Right. Because when I think of a sideswipe, I usually just think of scraped paint and maybe a broken side mirror. How does a sideswipe result in a $5 million jury verdict?
It comes down to the biomechanics of the human body and how cars are engineered. Vehicles are designed with massive crumple zones in the front and the rear to absorb straight-on impacts.
Okay.
But the sides of a vehicle have very little space to absorb energy before that force just breaches the passenger cabin.
So the energy transfers directly to the occupant.
Exactly. And specifically to the spine. I mean, the human spine is designed to flex forward and backward. It is absolutely not designed to handle sudden, massive, lateral, shear forces.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when a vehicle is sideswiped at highway speeds on, say, the Hutchinson River Parkway, that sudden lateral G-force can cause devastating herniations in the cervical and lumbar spine.
Which requires surgery, right?
Often multi-level spinal fusion surgeries. The severity of the injury is vastly disproportionate to what the external damage to the car might look like.
That perfectly explains the next number on the list. A $3.75 million verdict for a motor vehicle crash involving severe spinal injuries, along with a $3 million verdict for a Bronx collision.
Right.
These aren't windfalls. These are calculated funds required to keep a person from total financial ruin when they are facing a lifetime of chronic pain, lost wages, and future surgeries.
The financial recovery is the metric of success, sure, but the source article also highlights the client perspective, which I think reveals the duality required to do this job well.
Yeah, the text includes some very vivid testimonials. One client calls him, quote, a beast in the courtroom, an excellent lawyer, which makes total sense. You want a gladiator when you are fighting a massive insurance conglomerate.
But you cannot just be a blunt instrument.
Right, because another client says, he got me a bigger settlement than I expected. And the text specifically notes that clients frequently highlight his compassion and responsiveness.
It is a totally necessary balance. You have to be incredibly aggressive with the opposing counsel, but deeply empathetic with the client. I mean, they are likely going through the most traumatic, painful experience of their life.
They need a guide, not just a fighter. Again, that number, if you need it, is 914-485-4444.
So if we pull all of this together, looking at the fragile roadways, the physics of chain reaction crashes, and the adversarial insurance landscape, what is the ultimate takeaway for the listener here?
I think the source makes a really compelling argument that geography and circumstances might change, like whether you are rear-ended in Cortland or sideswiped in Brooklyn. But the fundamental power imbalance does not.
No, it never does.
The moment a severe crash happens, you are fighting a two-front war. You are desperately trying to heal your broken body while simultaneously trying to protect your financial future from corporations that are basically designed to minimize your pain.
And relying on goodwill or, you know, the obviousness of the police report is just a losing strategy.
100%.
Experienced legal representation, someone who actually understands both the biomechanical realities of the injuries and the tactical playbook of the adjusters, is literally the only mechanism available to level that playing field.
Yeah.
It's what secures the compensation necessary for past medical bills, future care, and just the intangible destruction of your quality of life.
It really is about taking the power back, which actually leaves me with a final thought I want to throw out there for you to mull over.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
We spent a lot of time today talking about the analog struggle to find the truth, right? Fading skid marks, conflicting eyewitness testimony, human error. But we are currently in the middle of a massive technological shift. Smart cars are constantly tracking GPS data.
Oh, yeah.
Advanced black boxes are recording steering wheel angles, braking pressure, and lateral G-forces down to the millisecond.
The data landscape is just expanding exponentially.
Right. So as this technology becomes standard in literally every car on the road, will the multi-vehicle blame game soon be decided entirely by flawless algorithms rather than human testimony?
That's a fascinating question.
And if we do reach a point where fault can be mathematically proven in an instant by a computer, will these massive insurance companies use that flawless data to finally help victims get paid faster? Or will they just use it to find microscopic algorithmic technicalities to deny claims entirely?
Well, given their historical playbook, I think it's a question we should all be asking.
Definitely something to think about the next time you are gripping the steering wheel, merging onto the Taconic, and just hoping the person behind you is actually paying attention. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.